Welcome to the REI Diamonds Show with Dan Breslin, your source for real estate investment jewels of wisdom.
All right, welcome to the REI Diamond Show. Doug, how are you today?
Good. Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, for sure. When the booking request came through, I was personally most excited about the operator developer. You guys have a huge background at Shoreham Capital of very large projects, it seems like, from all the research that I've done. I probably can't do as much justice on an introduction as you. So why don't I give you the floor, allow you to give an intro on kind of your career, Shoreham Capital, and what the trajectory of your guys' investment strategy looks like today.
Sure. Perfect. Well, again, thanks for having me, and I'm happy to introduce myself and then tell you a little bit about Shoreham Capital. So my name is Doug Farron. I've spent most of my career on the institutional investment side of the real estate business. So I started my career in investment banking. I then went to work in corporate private equity for a number of years, and then transitioned after business school to real estate private equity, working with a firm called the CIM Group based out in Los Angeles. I spent about 10 years at CIM, had a really great experience, and ultimately was a managing director on the investment team and running their East Coast investment practice. But I had shifted from corporate to real estate, really looking, one, both being very interested in the asset class and also being interested in trying to do something entrepreneurial one day. I felt that in real estate, there's a much bigger opportunity for that than in corporate private equity. And so after about 10 years with CIM, I was doing some family events and otherwise decided it was sort of the right time to take a look. And looking for a seed to that thesis or a seed for that business. One of the areas I've been really interested in at the firm and we'd been working on a white paper on was single family rental. And so I had been pursuing that, and through a friend was introduced to one of my partners, Nick Zumas, who's a sizable home builder in both New York and Florida. And so in meeting Nick, we sat down and had the opportunity to flesh out a business plan to shift a lot of his forward pipeline from for sale to for rent, but along the backs of that, build a larger real estate developer, operator, investor that would do both traditional multifamily, both ground up and value add, alternatives like build to rent, single family rental, senior student, and then also still have an allocation for special situations and sort of the background I had of doing different asset classes, debt and equity, wherever the sort of the opportunistic opportunity is. So that was sort of how Shoreham came together. And since inception, which really started in the beginning of 2022, we're currently in construction on about 700 units. Mostly in Florida. We have a large multifamily project in Fort Myers we're working on with the Bridge Investment Group. We have a 175 home community in Orlando that we structured a forward sale that's attached 3 and 4 bedroom homes. We're forward purchasing from a national home builder project in Naples. And then we're working on entitling some land sites. So, across all that, it's about 700 units in construction, about 1,200 units that we're currently entitling and contract on and probably building sometime next year. And then, we're pretty focused today on existing assets as we've sort of seen the trade from development move to existing assets. And, today looking at a lot of traditional multifamily and townhome product that's currently built and operating and has value add opportunities. So spending a lot of time there.
Yeah, tremendous number of projects. I lost count as I'm taking notes here of everything. Can you give us just an overarching broad number? Is there like an assets under management number or something of that nature that kind of puts the scale of Shoreham where it is for the listener?
Sure. It's 700 units under construction and 1,200 units in entitlement and sort of in preparation for construction. So you'll call about 2,000 units that we expect to have in development or stabilized in the next 2 years, and then working on a number of large existing assets. So I think the goal here would be to have, somewhere between 3,000 and 5,000 units in operation in the, 24 to 36 month timeframe.
Yeah, it seems like it's off the charts from my perspective. I get to talk to a lot of operators. And normally we'll hear the operator has, let's say, 300, 500, maybe they even just got the first 100 in, or they have 2,000 here, I am taken aback and shocked right now myself, because it's 2023, interest rates are high, inflation's through the roof, and yet you're setting out to build this portfolio of 2,000 units in probably the worst development cycle in most of the people's listening real estate career, certainly since 2010, 2011, no one was building much of anything. And building became much more challenging in 2022 and 2023 because of the inflation and because of the interest rates. How the hell are you doing that, Doug?
Well, I mean, I think there's sort of two questions in there. I mean, the first piece is sort of thematically and from sort of a thesis perspective. You know, I've always sort of, I think being contrarian, you know, if you're smart and strategic about it, can be well rewarded. So I think the fact that most people are shying away from development and construction now is precisely the reason that we're focused around it. I think we think, you know, of the projects we had and the ones we're talking about in construction are all capitalized now. So those projects, you know, we have debt and equity for, we're moving forward on. And what's great is we think we deliver into a moment when there's very little competition. I think the fact that it's very, very difficult to get financing now, it's very, very difficult to make sense of construction given the cost of capital, given, you know, nagging high construction costs. So, you know, we have projects that we, you know are underwritten to high enough yields that they, you know, sort of survive the, you know, current environment, both in terms of cost of capital and where exit cap rates have moved to. Some of the, one of the projects we're working on is an opportunity zone deal. So again, that's a bet on sort of the 10-year horizon of a location, not the 1 to 3 year horizon location. Because what I'd say is we're watching the market and feel strongly that, you know, there are real headwinds. And I think there's very likely, you know, recessionary environment that we're walking into. We're not really focused on that. We're focused on the other side of that. So we think if we're sitting on the other side of that with this pipeline of new construction in what has been a housing shortage for a long time and is only going to be exacerbated by the lack of deliveries, that we're going to be the product that people really need at the moment when there's no one else out there. So, I mean, on the development and construction side, that's been why we've been so focused there. At the same time, for a long time, there was no real interest in existing assets. And so these existing assets were, you know, 2 and 3 cap and 3.5 cap, you know, existing multifamily projects. And for me, it was hard to imagine how buying at a 2.5 or 3 cap, you could really make a lot of money on that unless, you know, rates inverted and went negative. So that wasn't interesting to me. As you're starting to see, you know, cap rates in the 5.5, 6 range, you're seeing prices, you know, in bases in the sort of 150 to 200 per door range, where they might have been 400 a door before, you're now 50% of replacement cost. And so, you know, we still like what we're building, but we're also seeing opportunities to pick up, you know, slightly older assets at a much lower basis that give you a cost advantage. And we think that by complementing all the development we're doing with some of these larger yielding existing assets, that helps us weather the near-term recessionary storm and be there to deliver new product into that next environment.
What is the cost per door on one or two of these projects, for context, to build out of the ground right now?
So, I mean, it really varies on construction type, right? So the and unit size. So we're building, you know, in Fort Myers, 900 square foot average product. It's a more traditional apartments, you know, 1, 2, and 3 bedroom. And I think we'll end up in that project in the mid to high 200s a door, which, frankly, you couldn't replace right now. We were fortunate to buy a site that had a lot of existing infrastructure on the horizontal side done. So even though it looked like we might have been paying, you know, 20 a door, you're really paying almost nothing a door because all this horizontal work had already been put in place and infrastructure on the ground. On the single family rental side, the construction cost on 4-story block and plank, which is what we're building in Cape Coral, is in and around the, you know, 200 per gross square foot on the hard cost side. On a comparative basis, the single family rental product we're building for between 110 and 130 or 140, depending on where, what quality, what size, per gross square foot. So there's real cost advantage there, but you're often building these bigger boxes. So you're all in that is still somewhere between like 250 and 350 a door, depending on, you know, that's typically where we are. It can extend up if you're doing a higher end product, but for what we're doing mostly, it's in that sort of 250 to 350 a door all in.
Can you give me an idea of the idea of the yield to cost that you guys are underwriting? Let's say, I don't know, if it's year one when this thing, or year two when it's stabilized, what percentage of a return on the investment are you guys going to get?
Sure. So, you know, in today's environment, we're spending a lot of time looking at, I mean, what is the base rate? Where is it moving? And how much spread and cushion to that do we have? You know, because all the sort of cap rate is directly related to base rate. I would say that when we launched the business, you were seeing people develop to five, 5.5. And that was really scary to us. That was, they were still sort of avoiding that on the multifamily side. And we really liked development of build to rent because you could still build to that 6.5, 7, you know, even 6.75 range, just out of having sort of less folks in the space, cheaper cost to build, et cetera. So we've been pretty anchored to building to north of a 6.5 regardless. I think the recent, you know, increase in rates has only pushed that further. So I think today we're only developing to a 7 on some new projects we're looking at, maybe 6.75, you know, depending on where the location is. I think we're able to buy existing, you know, either at TCO or leased up product, relatively newer in the, you know, we're trying to buy in the, call it 6 range, 6.25, 5.75 to 6.25, depending on the strength of location. But as cap rates continue to creep up, that 5.75 to 6.25 is probably now 6, 6.5. So it's a moving target. I think, you know, we're triangulating between yield, basis, you know, new product versus old product. And when we're looking at existing, it's also, you know, yield can be somewhat fungible because, you know, if it's, you know, an operational upside or renovation upside, we're a little bit less focused on what are we buying it at. We're more focused on what is the untrended yield, which again, we want in that sort of mid sixes range. And then we're picking locations that have growth. So everyone's scared, you know, it's absolutely possible that we'll see flat to negative growth in a lot of markets over the next 12, 24 months, potentially. But again, we're not looking at investments on the next 12 to 24 months. Everyone we're partnering with, the capital we're going in with is, you know, at a minimum, you know, 3, 4, 5, 7 years. If it's a 3, 4 year group, they're comfortable holding for 6, 7 years. And so we're picking locations that, again, I can't tell you there won't be some negative headwinds in the next 12 months, but over the next 5 to 7 years, we're, you know, highly convicted that you're going to see, you know, in excess of historical inflationary growth. So we're underwriting 3, but our view, and, you know, using the research tools we do, we're looking at, you know, north of 5% projected growth in a lot of these markets. And so to us, you're getting an untrended yield in the 6.5 to 7 range that puts you closer to 8 by the time you exit. And we feel very strongly that cap rates, you know, we think will stabilize somewhere in the, you know, mid, low to mid 5s range once the sort of noise comes with rates coming up and eventually rates stabilizing.
Especially with the quality product that new construction would offer in an instance like that. What is the exit strategy for you guys? Is it a refinance to take out investors, a hold long-term? What do you guys do in the end here?
You know, it can depend on a deal-by-deal basis. I mean, certainly the opportunity zone development we're doing is a 10-year hold, and, you know, we'll see thereafter. But I'd say on a typical project basis, you know, within the build-to-rent space, we do think there's a real opportunity to aggregate a large portfolio. And we think there's large investors that have great appetite for build to rent, but don't have access to, nor the ability to roll up the, you know, 100 to 300, you know, doors per property. And so our view is we'd like to buy, build, you know, those 100 to 300 unit properties, aggregate them together in that, you know, 2,000 to 4,000 unit portfolio and present them to the large pension fund, the foreign sovereign, those groups that are the large endowment, the folks that want to be in this space but need someone to aggregate it for them. And we think there's a tremendous opportunity to do that. Are we still doing some deals on a one-off basis? Absolutely. And does each of these deals have to make sense on their own? For sure. But I do think there's an aggregation play within the space to be done.
Do you guys use third-party management or in-house?
So to date, we're, you know, working with third-party managers. I think for us, it's really a question of scale. I think at a certain scale, you know, I'm not sure if we would fully take it in-house, but we're currently interviewing and trying to bring on our own property management focused personnel. And so they can interface directly with that third party for now, whether we decide to build our own team or just have more folks directly overseeing these third parties is to be determined. But we definitely want to have our own people and focus on the asset management of the deals we build and buy.
How are you guys dealing with the insurance challenges right now? I mean, we've gotten some of these renewals or non-renewals, and it is shocking.
It is a very big topic, and a very big topic, especially here in Florida. I actually had a lunch today on exactly that. I think there's a number of factors here that we have to take into account. There's been massive growth of insurance across the country, and part of that is directly related to inflation. And if you think about the fact that your replacement cost has gone up more than 2x for all of this property, it would make sense that all of these insurers, if they were insuring your house for $1 million and now it would take $2 million to rebuild it, they're going to have to make you pay more because now you have $2 million of coverage instead of one. So that's one piece of the puzzle. In Florida, you have some other complicating factors. You have some recent large storms like Ian last year. You have some unfortunate, you know, needed tort reform relative to some legislation that allowed for, you know, roofers and some law firms to sort of conspire to, you know, create claims against roofs that really may have not been storm related that caused a big issue for a lot of insurers. And then, you know, nationally, you have a lot of, you know, large recent claims. So all of this put great strain on the system. Some of those Florida specific things drove insurers and providers out of the market completely. And so today you're looking at less providers in the market with limited capacity. And so they're only going to put out a certain amount of capacity in this market. And the unfortunate outcome of that is that it really doesn't even matter where you are in the state. If you're placing a policy in the state of Florida, you're going to pay a big premium. Now, the good news is that is sort of a through the end of the year problem. This market sort of refreshes in January, and at the current rate of profitability, you're seeing new entrants come into the market. So it's our view that you should see a stabilization or perhaps even some relief into next year as, you know, knock on wood, assuming there's no major claim events, where there's just, you know, the reinsurance market should straighten itself out. Insurers should be there. And then bear in mind, as interest rates rise, these insurers are getting, you know, much higher yield from their assets on their books. So there's a number of ways that they're, you know, able to sort of make up for some of the larger losses they had. And hopefully that should translate to at least stabilization, if not a little relief to the user. But, you know, time will tell.
This isn't the first time. I mean, I might be, you know, a younger guy with less experience in the insurance. I'm sure that these kind of problems happened back, you know, mid-2000s and that kind of thing. And they sell themselves out. The market forces reach some sort of equilibrium somewhere in there. Doug, you had mentioned, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, I was with a 30-year veteran today, and he said, you know, if I can tell you one thing, it's that the insurance market always ebbs and flows. So it should correct, and, you know, at least in the near term.
Yeah, don't all markets ebb and flow, it seems like. you'd mentioned underwriting and building to like the 6.5 cap originally. Now we would like to see the 7 cap. Where does, right, the adage in real estate, or certainly for the asymmetric risk-seeking investors such as ourselves, is that the money is made on the buy. And I've heard a lot of people say, well, you can't buy the land any cheaper. Maybe you can. The projects you guys pulled the trigger on, it was a cost basis in the land kind of a thing, or did you guys find operational efficiencies in the construction that are giving you this edge and this higher yield, or both, or some other factor I'm unaware of?
Sure. So I think there's a couple of pieces there. I mean, the land is a relatively small percentage typically of the total project cost. So to a certain extent, you know, you've seen land come down 50% or more in certain instances, but it may or may not help because your cost of capital has, you know, risen 4 to 5 fold. And your construction costs, especially in growth markets like Florida and the Southeast that are still delivering, has been pretty stable. Maybe not, you know, skyrocketing the way it was, but they sort of have leveled off. So, you know, whether or not the land has gotten cheaper, it may not matter. Often also, like, landowners have owned the land for a long time. So they just saw their land, you know, they think is worth whatever it was, you know, 12 months ago. And if they're not getting that number, they're, you know, they sat on it for 40 years or 100 years or 20 years, and they'll sit on it again. So if some of it's that, I think there is some better flexibility in terms on deals where you can, you know, tie something up subject to, you know, getting a site plan approval or getting the site shovel ready, and that disappeared in the heat of 21 and 22. And so it's nice to see sort of that reasonable level back, which is really better for buyer and seller. You get the land to the point where it can actually be utilized. And if the, you know, buyer transacts, they, then they've made the sale. If they don't, you know, as the land seller, you're getting the benefit of that. So I think, you know, that normalization is important. To your question, how we're achieving those yields, you know, my partner being a home builder and his business, Nick, is really critical to what we're doing. So him being able to control costs, us being able to really be certain of hold period and construction period and materials costs and really deliver to our numbers, I think that's the key to us to being able to continue to develop. You know, clearly we bought a lot of this land very well, we think, but being, you know, very certain about construction costs, I think that's the difference between us being able to build and some other folks that are unable to do so. And I'm not sort of, I think a lot of what we've, you know, put in construction, you know, fortunately we held to very high yields. It took a hard, it's a hard thing to find. Right now it's very difficult to find deals like that. And so we're spending a lot of time. You got to find that needle in the haystack where you're actually achieving that 6.5-7 yield on an untrended basis. It's not getting easier in the current capital markets environment because we look at untrended leverage. So we're looking at the carrying cost of the land too, which has gone up as a result of cost of capital. But, you know, we're with the execution capability in-house, we think that helps a lot.
Can you describe maybe the needle that you found in a haystack sometime in the last 6 to 9 months? Because the needles have gotten fewer and far in between, it seems like to me, in 2023 for a lot of reasons. Maybe I don't even know what the reasons are. I don't know if it's the location is prime, the land is flat, it's in a flood zone, it's not in a flood zone. I mean, what is it that makes the needle in the haystack, Doug?
Well, I mean, there's a lot of factors that make the needle needle, and then all the things you talked about, location is critical. I'd say, you know, we've always been very location focused, and, you know, what I'd advise everyone is, especially in a market like this, you need to be, you know, laser focused on best possible location, because the first things to go south in an environment like this are the secondary and tertiary. I don't mean markets. I just mean like secondary and tertiary locations to a product. So for, you know, build to rent, for example, like we want to be in that, you know, 20 to 30 minute or less commute zone to, you know, employment centers, to, we want, you know, neighborhood retail not far, you know, that 45 to an hour drive site that, you know, we sort of call Edge of the Orange Grove in Florida, that's a sea of homes, like that stuff worries me significantly. And there are certain places that have the population growth support it, but if you're too far out there, you know, that's the stuff people say, oh, well, you know, rents have dropped, I can now afford the better house that's 20 minutes away from work rather than 40, I'm going to do that. And as much as we believe in the fundamentals of the sector built rent, one of the advantages for the renter is it's a year lease. So when it's up, and if they don't like the location, they can move. So hyper focus on location in an environment like this is really key. But I think it's staying very focused on all the fundamentals, you know, not sacrificing, not stretching to get a deal done, finding those great locations, and then being sure, you know, if you're buying it, you're buying it the right basis. If you're building it, that you can develop it and execute on time and on budget.
You had described the deal closing subject to the site plan approval or the construction drawing approval, getting the site shovel ready. And you said we're getting back to that now in 2023, and we weren't there in 21 and 22. And I have some friends who were selling product to the national home builders, and there was, you know, that proverbial rich idiot who was stroking the check without the approvals, who didn't know what he was doing. He probably got lucky on five deals. Now he's caught on the sixth. You know, if he exists, I don't know of a guy exactly like that, more of an avatar. When the money was loose in 21 and 22, there was a lot of foolish money that did go to settlement, overbid for the land, took it as is, and took all of the entitlement risk upon themselves unnecessarily. So is the business prior to 2021, it was kind of more the normal way of doing things would be, hey, our offer is going to be $1 million, but we have to get it rezoned and we have to get it approved for, you know, 110 units. And is that how the business operated before, Doug, in your experience?
Yeah, I mean, what I would say is you're right. There's absolutely this environment where if you wanted fully, you know, land, especially marketed land, that you were taking it as is, you were buying it in, you know, 90 days and you had none of that. I think it has served me well in my career to sort of stick to those same fundamentals wherever the market moves. So, what happens when the market gets crazy like that is I don't get to buy a lot of land because I'm not willing to take entitlement risk. I'm not willing to go on a limb for stuff like that. And I'm just going to shift to either finding off-market deals, finding partnerships with landowners where they'll work with you because you're taking some of the upside. I think you shift focus that way. I don't like eroding from some of those basics of, you know, why take that entitlement risk? Why close in that deal before you know actually what you're getting? And listen, a lot of people make money that way. I think it's a, you know, can be a high risk, high return strategy. I'm not faulting anyone for it. I just think, you know, what we've promised to our investors is good risk adjusted return, you know, solid fundamental real estate returns. And to me, that means, you know, putting yourself in a position to do very well when you get lucky, but always be in a position where you make, you know, a solid return on your investment. And I think, you know, we're not trying to take those crazy risks. We're trying to be, you know, solid singles, doubles, and triples, and the occasional home run is great.
Can you describe for me the timeline, maybe on a real deal that you guys actually already went to settlement on, but was one of these subject to the site plan approval deals? I mean, are we talking 6 months? Is this a year? Is it a 2 year kind of a deal? What is that? In what state, what market, you know, would that be?
So it really can vary, right? Because it depends at what status the land was when you sort of were able to contract it. For example, you know, we had one transaction in Orlando that we had, but we're buying from actually another home builder that was partially through the finalizing of the entitlement and the site plan, and we were in close site plan approval. So that was, you know, was supposed to be a 4, ended up being a 6 month period between sort of contract and purchase because they were further along as we went. And, you know, an instance we're working on now, you know, the hope is that it's, you know, 5 to 9 months, depending on how quickly we can move on the entitlement and get our engineer to move and really get the county to move and sort of where we're working. In other instances, it might be 18 months because, you know, you have to first, you know, get your site plan designed and then bring it up and sort of get it through that process. So it really does depend. And, you know, the flexibility of your seller is going to determine whether you have the time you need. You know, our offer is the same. It's, you know, listen, it doesn't matter where the land is today. We're unwilling to close until it's at that final site plan approval, until we know we can build what we can build, until we're as close as possible to shovel ready. And listen, in some instances, sellers aren't willing to take it, and we totally understand. But, you know, I think in most cases, especially a time like this, sellers are willing to work with us because they know, I mean, we're spending real dollars to get there. And, you know, what you have in real estate is your reputation. So I'm trying to stand behind, you know, every time we say we do what we say, we do it. And I think that gets people comfortable, and we're happy to provide people with references. And I think sort of doing what you say in this business goes a long way with finding, you know, folks that are willing to partner with you, even, you know, sort of as a seller and a buyer, that sort of partnership.
So are these deals usually done off market, or are you able to get some of these approved when there are agents involved? What does that exact presentation look like when you're attempting to get a seller to agree on a subject to site plan approval type of deal?
So often these are off market or somehow indirectly. Maybe there is a, you know, broker of sorts involved, but you know, the broadly marketed process, especially like we talked about, when the market's super hot, like 21 and 22, you know, you're probably not getting a broadly marketed process subject to final site plan approval. You know, however, there are instances where, you know, as the market is slowed, you might have a marketed, you know, land opportunity where you are able to negotiate those terms, especially as you educate the buyer that someone else may tell you that, but then when they figure out what actually has to happen, they're going to retrade you anyway. So I'd say more often than not, we're trying to do deals direct. We're trying to work directly with owners. And, but we're certainly willing and work all the time with brokers and, you know, sort of working with their sellers and trying to figure out how do we bridge the gap between what they're looking for, both from a value and a time perspective.
Yeah. And usually if the broker is there, at least in my experience, they know enough about the land to be dangerous to the deal in a sense. And what I mean by that is, they're sure the square foot price or the per acre price is the post-approval development value as they're listing the property. And they kind of don't really want to hear the subject to the site plan approval. And they have no idea a lot of times what's involved in that 5 to 8 month, 9 month, 18 month process. Most of the agents are completely unaware of that. So I would think trying to describe that deal through the agent who knows just enough to be dangerous, who's then going to translate that to the seller, is near impossible. So as I say that, I guess my follow-up question is, are you insisting if you were in that scenario where you have the broker who happened to be like family friend of the landowner or whatever the case is there some insistence of like, hey, can you guys come meet at the office, or can we like meet in person, or is there a way where you're getting like some direct face-to-face to be able to communicate and describe this and have that credibility with the seller, with the third-party broker involved?
So I think in almost all instances in a deal with time like that, you want to sit with the seller. Because I think you want to sit down, look them in the eye, and explain what that process is going to look like so you don't have any misconception and issues down the path. So I think, you know, in almost every case, you know, the broker will eventually say, okay, or, you know, we're saying to the broker, we'd really like to sit with the seller. We'd like to explain the process. We'd like to talk to them about what we're going to do. So we don't want there to be some misconception where they thought we'd be done in 3 months and we're actually done in 18 months. So I think having that sit down, looking people in the eye and talking through what you're going to do is very important. I think brokers, you know, it really varies, right? Sometimes it's like the family, friends doesn't really understand the space. But, you know, as long as they're willing to listen, that can be helpful. In other instances, I've had brokers be incredibly helpful. Again, really brokering the transaction, really explaining to the seller and being, you know, a lot of landowners sort of fall in love with their piece of land. And so you need someone sort of in the middle saying, well, listen, this is where the market is. This is your offer. They said they do this, and this is what works. So I think, you know, a broker can be a really helpful and important part of the transaction. Sometimes they can be your hindrance. So it's sort of navigating which version you have.
Yeah. And a lot of times, the larger the deal, at least in my experience, the larger the deal, the better sometimes it is that there is a broker there to be a third party, at least if the expectations of the seller are beyond what the market price is today, that broker can be the objective third party versus, you know, how can I trust anything the buyer is telling me about what the market is? He's obviously just trying to get a good price. Let me switch gears here for us and let's talk through investors. So you guys will raise capital on a deal or maybe a fund. Maybe you could share kind of the structure and the expectations that if I were going to invest with Shoreham Capital, you know, what would I expect from you guys, Doug?
Sure. So there's a couple of different ways that we interact with investors. We have a GP fund, which is primarily made up of, you know, high net worth or family offices, sort of a, not huge checks. You know, these are, you know, helping us capitalize the GP portion of the transaction. And so, you know, those folks are getting diversity across all the deals we do. We sort of bring them into every transaction and they're getting that first look. And for the larger investors in that vehicle, they're actually sharing a piece of the promote. So all of them are enjoying unpromoted returns. So actually better returns than the LP. And then some of the larger investors actually get a pro rata share in the promote. So that, you know, it should generate very healthy returns for that class investor. They're going into discretionary funds, so they're sort of trusting us to do the right types of deals, but they're also diversified across all the deals we do. And, you know, we've had some very good interest and appetite in that. The second way we interact with investors is, you know, raising the actual LP for each transaction. So on that side, our typical transaction size is usually like 50 to 200 or even 250 million. So those LP equity checks are anywhere from 25 to 100. That is typically ends up being, you know, large institutions. So real estate private equity firms, large family offices, sometimes directly with pensions or endowments. And so with that group, that, you know, the GP fund is diversified across all of our deals. The LP investors are a deal by deal basis. So we're bringing them a transaction, we're showing them an underwriting, we're showing them our research, and we're saying we're looking for, you know, typically one party who will partner with us as our LP.
Interesting. And I guess that cuts down on maybe reporting and the number of phone calls, but maybe you're doing that in exchange for very favorable terms to the LP. Fill me in on kind of the dynamics of the LP, the profit split with the GP, and some of the thought process. I guess, you know, it would be a nightmare to raise $100 million from 50 and $250,000 investors.
Yeah. So the reality is, you know, those types of investors, those smaller investors are really in our GP fund. For the LP checks, these are, you know, $100 million in one transaction. That transaction has to happen very quickly. So, you know, we think it would be very challenging to go out and raise $100 million from 100 or even 100 investors but while trying to get something done timely. So, you know, we're going to the folks that can, you know, quickly write a $25, $50, or $100 million check. And, you know, fortunately, throughout my career, having lived on that side of the business, been an LP for, you know, a long time, I built relationships with a lot of other folks like that. And I also know what that group is looking for when they evaluate a transaction. So we try and deliver a package that's very clean, underwrites the way I would have in my old job. And I think people appreciate, you know, some of the clarity and candor. And that's how we've been able to sort of bring folks on board with us.
So you're doing a deal. I don't know. It's a $200 million deal and you need $100 million. The GP fund, I guess, is acting as the manager of this project. So what would be sort of the profit split or the preferred returns maybe the LP is getting? And then what does the GP get out of a deal like that?
Sure. So as you described, it's a $200 million transaction. You have a $100 million equity check. We're typically doing 95-5 or 90-10. So the GP fund would participate either $5 million or $10 million, depending on whether it's a 90-10 or a 95-5. You know, the partners of Shoreham are a large percentage of that GP fund, or sizable percentage of that GP fund, and then the GP investors are the balance. So the GP fund is the GP investor in every deal. We're large participants in that. And then the group that comes into the GP fund is in each of our transactions in that tranche. In terms of sort of promotes and splits, the GP investor, if they're a small investor, is getting the deal level return. So they're not diluted by any promote structure. However the deal does, they do, which we think people find very favorable. And the larger investors are actually benefiting from some of the promote economics that we've negotiated with the LP. So, you know, for folks that can write larger checks, you know, that becomes, you know, more interesting. So in terms of deal hurdles, it really depends on the deals and the structure, depends on duration. You know, I think it varies widely, but, you know, typically it's some sort of, you know, hurdle rates with a promote split above the hurdle, whether that's 6, 8, 10, 12, 15, and whether that's 20%, 30%, 40%, 50%, really depends on the deal structure, risk profile. But I'd say there's a pretty, you know, the market tends to stabilize in similar places. So it's not like you talk to, you know, three different institutional investors and the waterfalls are that different. They're typically pretty similar.
Okay. So, yeah, I mean, when I hear most of the GPs, LPs that I know of, we're probably talking about deals in the $5 to $10 million range. Maybe it's a $10 or $15 million fund and the splits are not 90-10 and they're not 95-5. But if you're doing the math on a $200 million deal and you took a 10% split on the GP, I mean, just simple numbers, I know it's not how it probably shakes out, but we're talking $20 million for the GP. And then you're getting this one large investment check. What are some of the other benefits of having the business at that scale? I mean, a $200 million deal, Doug, what are some of the benefits that you're going to enjoy there that the $9 million project that I was talking about on my last episode, it's just not going to have these kind of benefits of scale? Can you give me a couple examples of things of that nature?
Sure. No, I think it ends up being fairly simple. The challenges to doing larger deals is, and it's a curve. So once you get really large, then there's not as many people that can do them. But in sort of the bulk of, like, let's call it the $75 to $150 million transaction, it's a pretty crowded space because there's a lot of institutional investors that can write that check, you know, largely in the office of institutional investors. So for us, you know, you have to really differentiate in being able to find a deal off market or find land off market or, you know, find an angle that makes you differentiated to really create the alpha you want on those deals. So that's the hardest. With smaller deals, you know, if it's owned by a family, it's sort of forgotten. That's like the 9-10, you know, we got a $11 million deal yesterday, and honestly, really compelling. Great basis, great location. Would have loved to do it, but here comes the rub. You know, we're a small team and a growing team, but it's the same amount of work to do a $12 million transaction as it is to do a $150 million transaction. So for us, and I spent my career doing, you know, 100 to 300 million. I've done $1 billion transaction in my career. And so I'm very familiar with these larger transactions, some of the pitfalls, the third parties and groups you need to work with. And our team is pretty much all, you know, comes from institutional background. So we're all comfortable with deals of this size. It's much more efficient to be doing, you know, one $100 million deal rather than 10 $10 million deals. And both are great strategies. I have, you know, good friends that have, you know, done roll-ups of these smaller assets and there's amazing returns to be had. We try and, you know, sort of less reps, but be very, very specific and laser focused on the deals we do that are larger so that we can sort of produce those same risk adjusted returns.
And if we're going to be using a $200 million example to go another step further, Could this be the new construction that's a 300 unit, 400, 500 unit kind of a project? And then is that going to take a longer period of time or some longer phased out? I mean, is that like, it takes the same amount of time on the front end, but is the execution a 3 year versus a 1 year, right? Is there a longer kind of burn on assembling and stabilizing that deal at all? Or are they almost nearly the same in your experience?
You know, it varies to a point. Like if you're building a single multifamily tower, and if that tower is 50, 75, 100, 150 units, it's pretty similar. If that tower is 50 units versus 400 units, you start to get into a real duration difference in the construction and complexity. And again, whether it's a high rise versus mid rise versus a low rise, if it's single family rental homes or built to rent community, you know, there's a production timing for each home. Now you can scale, so you could bring in, you know, more of a larger sub base and try and, you know, instead of producing one home at a time, you're producing five homes or 10 homes at a time. So there's an ability to scale and sort of make up some of that timing. But you do hit a certain inflection point. And then with a single property, you know, one of the projects we're working on right now is, you know, a large land site where we are entitled for 850 homes. Now, I don't think we would deliver 850 homes at once. I think that'd be a very difficult, you know, absorption, lease-up period. I think you'd be cannibalizing yourself. So a project like that, we would phase. And so we'd intentionally, you know, probably do one, two, or three phases on that project, which will naturally, you know, run it out. And so then you have to just be careful. You have to take down the land all at once. But because, again, the land is 5, 10% of the total value, it's not so terrible to buy all of the land for 800 units, but then you just do the horizontal and the vertical on the first 250 or 300, and then you do your next 200 and so on and so forth. So it does add, it can add timing. It certainly can add complexity. But for us, the incremental, we prefer to do larger transactions. You know, listen, 200 is very large. I'd say we're more typically plus or minus 100 in what we're looking to do. But we have the capability to do the larger transactions. And you know, we like the ability to scale up and really build scale in the market. So we're looking at a large transaction now in a part of the world I spend a ton of time. And we see this large asset as a great opportunity to sort of plant a flag there, put our team on the ground there, and then be able to buy some smaller transactions that are proximate.
What would be the expectations for the general partner fund investors? I mean, is that a 10, a 12%, 15%, you know, total return? Is it going to be held for a 10-year period? Is this like an indefinite hold? What are the kind of capital return projections on the GP fund?
Well, the GP fund is targeted as being as a closed-end vehicle, and really, as you know, our first GP fund vehicle, we're really focused on returns and trying to produce outsized risk-adjusted returns for investors. So we're telling folks our target is between a 16 and a 24% return. The reality is, you know, we're not looking at anything that's less than a 20, and we're looking in excess of 30% returns in deals we're doing. So because we're delivering the deal level return to our investors, you know, we're hoping that we're delivering north of a 20% return to our GP fund investors. And the idea here is to show folks that, you know, sort of our strategy works, plant a flag, and the goal is to bring on investors who can grow with us and can sort of proselytize for us and tell more people about us, as we, because I think we're raising a small GP fund. The goal would be that our fund two will likely be a significantly larger operator allocator fund, because, you know, we sort of talked about in the beginning, not only do we do direct developing and operating, but I have a great deal of relationships with other developers. And I think in fund two, we'd love to be able to help some of those folks and partner and leverage some of the relationships and experience they have. But today, you know, the GP fund has had good reception amongst investors because we're promising and we're delivering. You know, the projects we're starting to, you know, transact on, and there's one we're going to start selling shortly. Even in today's environment, we've been fortunate enough to structure a pre-sale, and, you know, it's compelling returns.
Are there any year one tax advantages for us high earning real estate professionals? Do we get a good year one K-1 that knocks our tax basis down, or what?
I mean, we are certainly looking to be efficient, and, you know, where we can do cost segregation analysis or pass through losses. So I think there are, you know, we are, as all real estate funds, aiming to be, you know, tax advantageous and create, promote rather than just ordinary income. So we are, you know, like many other real estate funds, very focused on sort of passing through those savings to our investors.
What does that look like in year one? Is that like a one-to-one for this year, or no cost segregation, bonus depreciation taken? What is that usually?
I would want to look through our attorney before I quote you exactly, but I would tell you that we are focused on it and definitely going to pass through some of those savings to our investors.
Okay, cool. I know we're getting a little late in the hour. If anyone were listening and wanted to try to get maybe the OM or next steps, is that something you would make available to listeners?
Yeah, I think for folks who are interested, happy to have them reach out and have a conversation. Sort of sizable, our minimum's been, over 500,000 per investor. So, it's for those folks that can write those larger checks. Happy to sit down and explain our strategy and would love to have folks on board.
Very interesting. So you've had a very institutionalized path through the real estate, investment career there. It's very interesting. I'm curious if there are any book recommendations that maybe mentors or partners have handed down to you that you felt were pivotal throughout your career.
It's a great question. I think, I'm going to try and go more non-traditional, like real estate books. I think, I was given in college, Rich Dad, Poor Dad, which I thought was interesting. I'm sure you've heard from other folks before. I think that, reading the Art of War by Lao Tzu was pretty interesting, and Machiavelli, and sort of understanding operational dynamics and incentives in some of those classic books are pretty interesting. And then, there's some something about some like the local books on some of the projects. I tend to like to read about the history of some of the areas we develop in. So there's some great books about Florida and Cape Coral and some of the areas that we've been. It's sort of been interesting to understand the history, which I think helps you as a developer, sort of better situate what you're doing with some historical context into the market and with local municipality.
Do you know what that book was on Cape Coral?
I will follow up with you in an email. I'm blanking on the title, but I have it on my bedside table. I know.
I appreciate that. There was one, who was it? It was Rockefeller's partner whose name Henry Flagler.
Flagler.
Flagler did the East Coast of Florida with the railroad, I think, that he ran down there. And there's another guy whose name's escaping me who did the West Coast over here where I am. Which I think would be the Cape Coral area.
Swamp Peddlers was an interesting deal. About the development of Florida. And so Swamp Peddlers, and then the other one was Selling Dream. Those two are very interesting.
I can't wait. Can't wait there. So the crown jewel of wisdom, Doug, if you could go back and share with yourself in, just getting out of college early in your career, knowing everything you know now, what would you go back and share with yourself?
So I think that, there's two sort of pieces of wisdom. I think, thinking early on in your career, as much as you can, sort of easy to throw up your hands and say, I don't know what I want to do, but trying to figure out what you enjoy and where you envision yourself going and early in your career and sort of starting to take steps in that direction, I think is really important. Because I think once you firm up what your goal is, you can start to sort of take the concrete steps to get there. If you don't know what you're doing, you don't start building that. And I think people turn around 10 years into their career, deciding they suddenly want to do something, and it's, tougher to get back. I think the early steps in your career, it's easy to move towards your end goal. I think the second piece, and especially in real estate is such a relationship-oriented business. And so I sort of tell all the juniors, never eat, breakfast, lunch, or dinner alone. Just use the opportunity to, have lunch with people at your firm, with counterparties, with brokers, with, whoever you can gain wisdom from. You'll learn a lot from the experience. You'll build better relationships with the people you're with, and it just grows your network. And I think, especially the combination of understanding where you're trying to go and then grabbing lunch with those people, and not necessarily asking anyone for anything, just having lunch with them, learning about them, their trajectory, how they got where they are, and learning about their view of the market, especially when you're younger. It allows you to start to form a view in the market via a bunch of smart people that have, a little bit further along in their career. So, grab lunch and dinner and breakfast with people when you can and start to think about where you want to go.
Yeah, that is great advice. I mean, it's like you're not trying to get them. Like early on in my career, I had no money, right? So I was like, always my agenda was like, oh, can this guy fund my fix and flip deal, And a lot of them couldn't. And I probably should have been more curious about the path that they took. And like, for me, it's been a blessing to get to host this podcast, because I'm now given that second chance, if you will, to figure out what the path was. And it's this, this random input of information that, like snowflakes falling and accumulating over time, you know, on your career, on the path of your career, to be curious about all that information, because I didn't know the questions that I should have been asking or the information I should have paid attention to. So it's like to enjoy that random learning that can occur. And in the context of the breakfast, lunches, and dinners, I think that's a great, great tip there. Doug, what is the kindest thing anyone has ever done for you?
Kindest thing anyone's ever done for me. I think there's just been some great mentors throughout my career who've just given, you know, so much of their time to, you know, help develop my skill set, whether that was sort of modeling, negotiating, you know, just learning this business. And I think, and again, people taking those opportunities, you know, having lunch with me when I'm a young guy in my career and they have no reason to sit with me. So to me, I'm, you know, constantly trying to pay it forward, you know, take the random email or phone call, grab a, you know, whether it's a Zoom or a coffee or a lunch with people where I can, and share what I can. I think you have to pay forward the sort of, you know, benefits that you had in the past. So I think, you know, it's a great gesture that, you know, just follow up with people, reach out and share what you can.
Fantastic. So you had mentioned people reaching out. Where can listeners maybe reach out if they are ready to cut that $500,000 check, or maybe they just want to explore more about Shoreham Capital and Doug Farron and see what's out there about you? Where should they go to do that?
So shorehamcapital.com, our website, has a ton of great information. It's got our contact info on there. It's got our, you know, a bit more about the firm. And has, you know, sort of a lot of what we've been doing. So I would highly recommend people go there. You know, our emails are on there, so you can reach out to us or just, you know, the Shoreham Capital website, and we'll get back to you. So I would encourage people to check out our website, see what we're doing. And if they're interested in investing, you know, reach out. I'm, you know, Doug@shorehamcapital.com, and happy to have a conversation and see if it'd be a fit.
All right. Sounds good. Well, we are at the top of our episode, Doug. I really appreciate you coming on the show. I had a blast.
Thanks so much. Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
The REI Diamond Show is sponsored by Diamond Equity Investments, a private equity firm focused on buying and selling residential and commercial property throughout the United States. If you are an accredited investor seeking double-digit returns, you can sign up to review Diamond Equity's passive investment opportunities at www.fundrehabdeals.com. And if you're an investor who is seeking deals that you can buy, fix, and flip, please go to www.dealswithroi.com.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the REI Diamonds Show with Dan Breslin. To receive email notifications of new weekly episodes, sign up at www.reidiamonds.com.